Welcome to SLP Nerdcast. I'm Kate.
And I'm Amy, and we appreciate you tuning in. In our podcast, we review and provide commentary on resources, literature, and we discuss issues related to the field of speech-language pathology.
You can use this podcast for ASHA CEUs. For more information about us and CEUs, go to our website, www.slpnerdcast.com. SLP Nerdcast is brought to you by listeners like you. Even small contributions keep our CEU prices low and our program ad-free. You can contribute on our website by clicking Support Our Work. You can also go to our website to find permanent products, notes, and other handouts. Some items are free, others are not, but everything is always affordable. Visit our website to submit a call for papers to come on the show and present with us, and contact us anytime on Facebook, Instagram, or at info@slpnerdcast.com. We love hearing from our listeners, and we can't wait to learn what you have to teach us.
And just a quick disclaimer, the contents of this episode are not meant to replace clinical advice. SLP Nerdcast, its hosts, and guests do not represent or endorse specific products or procedures mentioned during our episodes unless otherwise stated. We are not PhDs, but we do research our material. We do our best to provide a thorough review and a fair representation of each topic that we tackle. With that being said, it is always likely that there's an article that we've missed or another perspective that we haven't shared. If you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, please email us. We do love to hear from you.
Today, we are so excited to welcome Dr. Robin Danczak onto the show. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're really excited to have you here because you are here to discuss why and how to incorporate writing into school-based SLP practice. And that is a big topic. And I think a lot of our listeners will be very excited to learn more about that. Before we get started, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am an associate professor of communication sciences and disorders at Emerson College in Boston. We live here in Boston, right in Back Bay. So it's been fun getting to know the city and exploring things, although it's been a little bit of a bummer since COVID hit, I have to say.
Yeah, totally.
At Emerson, I teach graduate and undergraduate courses. My graduate course is language and literacy disabilities, and it really incorporates a lot of the things that I'm going to be talking about today, which is, you know, the role, the relationships between oral language and reading and writing, and how we can utilize reading and writing in our SLP practice. My background is somewhat interdisciplinary. I did not come directly to communication sciences and disorders. I studied art history and Hispanic language and culture as an undergrad. And then I moved to Chile and did a Master of Arts in Linguistics in Spanish. So I was in Chile for 5 years. This is like way back in my 20s, you know, a long time ago. But it definitely shaped a lot of how my career unfolded since then. Coming back to the States, I taught Spanish for several years in Florida public schools. And at that time decided I wanted to go back to do a PhD and selected communication sciences and disorders. At that point, I started doing research with bilingual language, specifically adolescence and in bilingual writing. So I would say for, 12, 13 years now, I've been working with bilingual students who are typically developing and write in English and Spanish, for example. I also was fortunate to have a Fulbright Award and spent a semester in Italy. This was a few years ago. And
wow.
It was awesome, but the proposed reason for me to go there was to do research, right? So it was not just about like food and, you know, all those things to think about. But I went to Italy to do a research project with Barbara Arfay, who's a writing researcher. And we worked with Italian adolescents who are learning English in school and also analyzed their bilingual writing. So writing has been really important to me for the past decade plus. And I feel like it's just such a rich way to learn about not only the linguistic capabilities of students, but also their identities and their stories. And you can really bring in cultural relevance and authenticity to working with students when you're having them write things that are meaningful and important to them. So that's kind of been the basis for my research.
That is tremendously interesting in a lot of interesting places. And I have a lot of jealous feelings about going to Italy, even if it's for research. That sounds wonderful.
It was a great experience because I also got to really be immersed in life there. I was, living in university housing. I had a little visiting office at the university. I was able to participate in a couple students' thesis committees. I did some guest lectures and things like that. I went to conferences. It was a really amazing experience. If anyone is interested at all in international learning experiences, global learning, international education, I highly recommend it. Like I said, it's been really important to me, and I've also done some other things. This will become the whole podcast if I go into something. But I'm always, I always encourage my students to look into these things, look into Fulbright, look into international work opportunities, even grad school abroad, other types of things that if you have any interest in going to live overseas, you will not regret it. Go for it.
Well, it sounds awesome. Incredible. And I feel like now that you've teed us off with this incredibly interesting, history, I get to read these really boring financial and non-financial disclosures. So listeners, stick with us. Sometimes we have people write in and ask if we can skip this part and we can't. Asher makes us do it. Well, I'll try and get through it as quickly as I can. So our learning objectives for today, number one, explain the value of authentic writing to promote student engagement, motivation, and socio-cultural linguistic identity. Learning objective number two, analyze the student writing sample for microstructural versus macrostructural features. Learning objective number three, connect writing goals to language and speech outcomes, as well as to grade level curriculum and learning standards. Financial and non-financial disclosures. Kate, that's me. My financial disclosures, I'm the owner and founder of Grand Bois Therapy and Consulting, LLC, and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. My non-financial disclosures, I'm a member of ASHA Sig 12 and serve on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children. I'm also a member of the Berkshire Association for Behavior Analysis and Therapy, MassABA, the Association for Behavior Analysis International, and the corresponding Speech Pathology and Applied Behavior Analysis Special Interest Group.
Amy, that's me. My financial disclosures, I'm an employee of a public school system and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. My non-financial disclosures are that I'm a member of ASHA Sig 12, and I serve on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children.
Great. And I have no disclosures. I guess I need to note that I am an employee of Emerson College and a member of ASHA and ASHA Sig 14.
So we're so excited to have you.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have a discussion with you about all sorts of things. But I think a great place for us to start would be, can you tell us why should writing matter to school-based SLPs? Why is that something that should be important for us?
Great question, Amy. why should writing matter? Writing, oh my goodness. Thinking about how much information you can get about language from a student's writing. And, you can use a writing sample in your assessment of student language. You can also work on writing goals to kind of slow down language and really work through things in a systematic way with a student. Not to mention, writing is critical, right? If you're a school SLP, you're working with students who are in classrooms where they're using literacy to access content all day long, right? Especially beginning like in third, fourth grade, upper elementary and beyond. I mean, really, what do we have? Kindergarten, first grade, second grade, that's about it where you're like learning to read focus.
Right.
Beyond that, it's all about literacy, right? So in order to learn and demonstrate learning, you need to do it through reading and writing.
In your first learning objective, now maybe this is a dumb question, but we all love to say that there's no such thing as a dumb question, right?
No
such thing. You have the first part of your learning objective is explain the value of authentic writing. What do you mean by authentic writing, and how is that different from just writing, as the lay SLP would assume?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I came up with the idea of authentic writing, but I do talk about it a lot in my research, because I, as a researcher, my goal has been to work with kids in writing, not just to like produce a text that I can go off and analyze, but to learn something from text production and to actually feel like they're doing it for a real purpose. So for example, I worked with middle school English learners, and we did a big project using graphic novels, and the topic was immigration. And since these students were all English learners, many of them were immigrants, and if they weren't, their parents had immigrated. So the writing project that we created, and I was working, collaborating with the classroom teacher, was that the students would write their story's immigration narrative and then create a graphic novel or comic based on the story, right? We used a software called awesome. Comic Life. You might be familiar with that. The kids researched that we researched immigration in general. We did a lot of other things. We looked at graphic novels and how to create comics and graphic stories. They researched their families' immigration history. They wrote the narrative. They revised it. So we worked on skills like planning, right? Planning and organizing a text, writing your narrative, revising your narrative before we gave them access to the software. And they then like brought in photos and created these comics. So for them, that was a very authentic writing experience, because it was something that was really meaningful and important to them to write about. You know, similarly, you can work with kids on persuasive texts. So we have like two general genres, right? When we're talking about text, and this goes for reading as well. There's the narrative, which is like what we call a story. And, you know, a lot of you are probably familiar with story grammar as a way to analyze an oral narrative. I'm sure a lot of SLPs who are listening utilize story retell, right? Or some kind of oral narrative, maybe wordless picture book as part of your assessment. So narrative is a big thing that we use in the field. And that's especially important in earlier grades, right? Working with preschool, kindergarten, first grade, oral narrative is big. You can also use a written narrative, by the way, to find the same things. And then we have expository text. So I feel like this kind of ties in with the first question. And now I'm like, integrating all three questions so far. But the first question, why is writing important, right? You know, we talked about kids needing to learn to write, and something that is really critical that I think sometimes gets left out in the SLP world is working with expository text. So these are texts, again, reading or writing, that could be informational, provide information, could do some kind of compare contrast, could give an opinion or try to persuade you about something. So having kids write persuasives is another way to make a text authentic for them, because if they're really invested, if it's important to them to express their opinion about something, maybe it's about climate change or about, you know, some issue in their community or even something that they want to change about their school, they have a real reason to do it. So that makes it authentic.
And I feel like, you know, you're dropping the breadcrumbs beautifully for me, because I'm thinking about even the second part of your objective and how that's related to student engagement. And it's sort of, duh, you know, you're so much more engaged if you're engaging in a task that you're passionate about or that relates to you personally, or that you are hoping to get something out of. And I have to imagine that that's so much more powerful than, please write an essay about Abraham Lincoln, unless you're like super passionate about the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln, which a lot of us are, that's cool. But you know, there's something deeply personal about writing and writing something that is related to your own story.
Yeah, why not like write an essay about why you would want to create a skate park in your community. I mean, isn't that a lot more fun? And you can use the same the same process of learning the structure. And so this is where we get into like micro and macro structure, which I think is objective number two.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, we're talking so far, we've been talking about macro structure, which is like how the text overall is organized. A narrative, going back to narrative versus expository, a narrative, if you know story grammar, there are certain elements that will be part of your story. And then you have this episodic structure, right? Where there's like an initial event, some kind of action or problem that happens, some kind of resolution, a character response, right? And you have things like setting, characters, problem, conflict. These things are part of the narrative macro structure that we all are familiar with and that we sometimes have to work with kids on. How do you make your episode logical and cohesive and understandable to your listener or reader? Expository macro structure, again, there are different types of expository text. So, writing an informational text is a little different from writing an opinion or a persuasive text, right? And going back to objective one, why is this important too? Another reason to teach these structures is that it will help kids comprehend this when they encounter them in reading. So if they understand, okay, I'm writing an opinion or a persuasive text, so I have to like give my argument and I have to give supporting reasons for it, right? So I think there should be a skate park in my community because kids need a safe place to play, because kids need to be active and outdoors and get exercise, and because, give me a third reason, we need to have time to socialize and hang out with our friends. So now let's develop each of those reasons, right? And so we're learning about the structure of the text. So when you're reading something like that, you can also say, wait a minute, this author is trying to convince me of something and here are the reasons why. So as you know, with oral language, expressive receptive, right? It's the same thing with literacy. These comprehension of text and production of text can really support each other and go hand in hand.
I had a question related to I know we're like hopping back and forth between these learning objectives. We do that sometimes. It's fine. But thinking about the sociocultural linguistic identity and how that might weave itself through a personal narrative or an authentic narrative. Is that something that you found your students do, I was going to say authentically, do without, encouragement? Or is this something that you think is beneficial in the learning process?
I think that SLPs are really, would be or can be really good at this because SLPs are focused on creating interventions that are unique to the client, right? That are really address and focus on the individual student's needs. And so part of that is really learning about who this person is. And this is related to cultural competence, right? And cultural relevance and ideas like, intercultural agility, understanding who the client is, not just their language strengths and weaknesses, but like their background, their experiences. What are they bringing to the table? What are they bringing into school? Louise Mole and colleagues talk about funds of knowledge related to these cultural practices that kids learn to participate in, and through that they learn skills and they learn language skills. So if a kid, for example, spends a lot of time with grandparents gardening, they will be learning not just those skills but the language required of gardening, right? There are certain words, types of plants, tools, names of tools that you use, different types of soil, maybe weather conditions, things that are specialized vocabulary. We think about specialized vocabulary only happening in school, but it happens at home too. So the cultural linguistic relevance piece is figuring out, where is this kid coming from? What strengths and experiences can they draw upon to bring those to the classroom and to your SLP setting? And you can use those as topics of writing as prompts, writing prompts. You can use those to find texts that are interesting for them to read. You know, I always tell students, because another thing I'm really big on is talking about like Common Core standards. And I know not everyone uses the Common Core anymore, but at least for students, it's a good place to start to get an idea of what's expected at different grade levels. You know, what's in the curriculum, what's happening, what should students be able to do? And, you know, they're pretty challenging, right? So, you know, if kids are expected to be able to, for example, you know, synthesize information across different texts, it's great to use the science and the social studies classroom materials in your session, but maybe start with something you know they really like to get the strategies introduced and to start practicing with something that they will be able to engage with.
I wanted to zoom back a little bit and just connect with the work you were doing with the graphic novels. And what you mentioned when you were talking about that was that you were working together with the classroom teacher. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of what the speech language pathologist overall can bring to that collaboration with a classroom teacher. Like, what are some unique pieces? Because you've talked a little bit about the oral language component, and I think there are things that the classroom teacher is bringing that they know that we don't know, but I think there's also things that we can bring in to that.
Yeah, you know, a really good example of an SLP classroom teacher collaboration that recently was published is by Ginger Collins and Julie Walter. I can send you references here, but their project was related to developing morphological awareness, promoting morphological awareness in a classroom setting. And they were working on, I mean, the idea is, you know, RTI tier one, which is high quality instruction that's happening for everyone in the classroom. But that's another great example that I would recommend. As far as what the SLP can do and how to integrate that more specialized linguistic knowledge, something like that is really ideal. Working on specific things like morphology, derived words, vocabulary, tier 1, 2, 3 vocabulary. I mean, teachers are familiar with that too, but you know, you could do specific activities. And so this is where we're getting into microstructure, by the way. So we talked about macrostructure, like the general overall structure of a text. But within that structure, there are things like sentences, right? And SLPs, hopefully you guys know your grammar, right? You know about complex sentences, you know about, maybe you do something with sentence combining. I don't know, it's a great intervention for writing and oral language, using transition phrases, conjunctions, right? You know, so working that in is a great opportunity for the SLP, where, you know, maybe the teacher has a general project in mind where you're doing some kind of bigger writing project that involves doing some research, writing some drafts, making an outline, doing some revisions. So that's all happening. And maybe along the way, SLP can jump in and do a lesson or a small group pullout on, you know, how do we make the vocabulary more interesting here? How can we vary our descriptive words? Let's just focus on conjunctions and transitional words and phrases. You know, here are some conjunctions that mean the same as and. Here are some that mean the same as but. So you don't just have to say and but, right? You can say in addition, you can say however, you can say on the other hand. And so, you know, that fits really well with the revising piece. And it also works on oral language.
So I was going to say, just sort of like zooming out again and thinking about all of these different components and how writing is a key, should be considered a key component of what the SLP is considering, or that SLP should consider, microstructures, macrostructures, all of the different things you can do in intervention. I have to assume that this also is really important for assessment, that writing also has a key place in SLP assessment skills. Emma, is that hunch spot on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I would agree to that. I mean, I also really want to encourage listeners to not be afraid of literacy and to embrace it and to realize that, you know, this is not something new. In my class, for example, we look at an ASHA position statement on the role of the SLP in literacy from like 2001. So it's a really long time, you know, that ASHA has been saying that SLPs play a direct role in prevention, assessment, and intervention of literacy-related disabilities in schools. So, you know, this is not something to shy away from or to, you know, denounce as part of your role as the SLP. So think about ways. And the other thing is, you know, I bet you're already doing it. Like, if you think you're not, just think about how many times you do an oral narrative. Like, you're doing it, right? That's literacy right there. So, or how many times, you know, you read a book and ask comprehension questions. That's literacy right there. So writing is part of that literacy. And like I said before, you know, the comprehension and the production go hand in hand. They're like two sides of the coin. And you know what? I forgot your question.
About the role of writing.
Assessment. Okay, sorry. Right. So that was my little soapbox aside, like SLPs, get on board with literacy. But beyond that, assessment, another reason why you should embrace writing, because it can be really useful for assessment. For one thing, as part of your comprehensive language assessment for school age kids, you want to get some curriculum related samples. It would be great in your comprehensive assessment of this kid that you are looking at their schoolwork. And what are you going to look at? Probably writing and spelling. You can look at how are they producing language in written form. And pretty much anything you can do with an oral language sample, you could do with a written language sample, right? You can look at, you know, how productive is the writing? How many words or sentences can they produce in a given amount of time? How is the syntax? Are they, you know, using complex sentences? Are they able to produce a complete sentence with a subject, verb, object, right? Are they using verbs appropriately? Are they using inflectional and derivational morphology appropriate for their grade level? How's the vocabulary? You know, all those things you would do with an oral language sample, you can do in writing. And then you can also look at the macro structure. So like, okay, maybe they've got great sentences, but this narrative makes no sense. Like, I don't know where the beginning, middle, and end are. I don't know what really happened. What was the problem? I couldn't figure out who was who. So, you know, that's one challenge. Or maybe you're like, okay, there is a story here. I can figure out who are the characters, what happened, and, you know, I have a good sense of the structure, the timeline of things, but wow, they can hardly put a sentence together, or the spelling is terrible. And spelling, by the way, maybe we'll talk about too, but, you know, spelling is another whole linguistic thing we can talk about, and how it relates to phonology, orthography, and morphology, not just, you know, it's not mechanics. It's very complex.
So I have to assume, just by, you know, soapbox aside, which, by the way, we welcome soapboxes here, the information that you can glean from a writing sample sounds like it's much more, there's a lot of depth there. Is that an accurate assumption? I mean, everything from everything you're saying, the macro structures, the metacognition, organization, syntax, spelling, phonology. I mean,
oh, yeah. And you mentioned
there's a lot.
Cognitive. Yeah, metacognitive, we haven't even really talked about yet, right? You know, what about character thoughts and feelings? What about mental state verbs? What about
inferring what's going to happen next? Or
there you go. Predicting, inferring. Yeah, all of those things. And writing is a huge metacognitive skill. It takes a lot of planning, goal setting, organizing, lots of executive function there.
I know that we have a lot more to talk about, but before we sort of transition into some of these other specific things, do you, if someone is listening and wanting to learn more about how to analyze writing samples, or if they aren't that familiar with metacognition and how writing and metacognition are related, do you have additional resources where you can, or like, you know, resources where you can point people for that?
I could point to some text that I'm familiar with and that I use in my classes. For example, in the handbook on, is it on language and literacy or on reading and writing? I'll have to send you some links, but there's a great chapter by Carol Westby that's on metacognition.
Great.
And maybe we should just Google the handbook really quick.
And we, for anybody listening, all of these links will be in the show notes. So if you're on a walk and you are listening to this and curious, just swipe up or go through your podcast player in the show notes and all of these references and links will be there.
Okay, got it. So it's Addison Stone et al. Handbook of Language and Literacy, which, by the way, is a really awesome text. They're in the second edition now, which I believe is 2014. Check it out online, the table of contents. It can change your life. I mean, there's some really amazing chapters in there for school SLPs who are doing language and literacy. Another good text is Cami and Katz, Language and Reading Disabilities. It's right over there. There are some really good strategies in there for teaching comprehension, metacognition also. And I believe there's a chapter on spelling. Anyway, again, it's an edited text, so there are just a good variety of chapters in there. Teresa Ukrainitz has another text on school language, and she has a great chapter on narrative structure, where she talks about how to teach narrative, how to comprehend, help kids comprehend narrative, and episodic structure. So those would all be really useful resources.
That's awesome.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that's great.
That's awesome. We always like to leave people with some additional resources because it's a podcast. So people are out and about listening, driving, whatever. And it's nice to have something written down or a good place to go when, you know, when you're ready to look things up a little bit deeper.
Oh, there's another one.
Oh, good.
No, I love providing resources, but I feel like a really good one for writing in particular is Harris and Graham, Catherine Harris and Steve Graham's self. Let's see, RSD, self-regulated strategy development, SRSD, self-regulated strategy development, Harris, Graham, and others. They actually have a book on writing strategies for all kids or something like that, where they really spell it out and they give you a whole bunch of metacognitive strategies for how to structure, organize, write, revise, etc. Different types of text, narrative, different types of expositories. And their research, oh, nice. That group, those authors, their research has actually shown that the self-regulated writing or self-regulated strategy development in writing has been really effective for kids with language and literacy disabilities. So that's a great resource right there.
That's awesome. We will list all of these in the show notes. I'm wondering about that soapbox that you just got on there for a sec. If we could just like hop back on there real quick, because I have a question. As for the SLPs listening who feel like they don't necessarily have it in their scope of competence to work on writing, or based on their work setting or school setting, they don't feel like it is their role to work on writing. What would you have to say to that SLP?
It is their role. It is your role.
Okay, I mean, good.
I think.
Could you tell I asked you that on purpose?
Do we want to go back on the soapbox?
just for a little bit, just for like 2 seconds.
Well, okay, here's the thing. And like, I think we said, I probably said this already, and you know, but oral language is the foundation for literacy, right? And literacy is language. You can't read and write without language, whether it's oral or sign language, to tell you the truth, right? If you are a deaf person who is a signer, you can use sign as a language that is the basis for your literacy learning. It's a little harder because you don't have the phonological connection, the grapheme phoneme mapping that we have when we have oral language and alphabetic writing, right? But still, that language comprehension is required for reading comprehension. So you can't take language out of literacy, for one thing. And then, you know, like I think I said before, how do kids use language in school? What are the language demands of school? And what percent of those language demands has to do with reading and writing? A lot. And more as the kids get older. So again, upper elementary, middle school, high school, in order to learn and in order to express themselves in the academic context, kids need to be competent readers and writers, and they need to be confident readers and writers. And you know, another thing that we talk about a lot in my class is James Paul G's work on situated language and learning, and this idea of literacy as a cultural practice, as opposed to an instructed practice. So, you know, something like, maybe something like mathematics or physics, you know, it's not something that you're gonna be doing in the real world, right? Just with, maybe you are, but it's not necessarily something that's like passed down as a family tradition, like cooking, which is a cultural practice. How can we make literacy a cultural practice? Making language a cultural practice is part of that. And I know you, the SLP listening, you know, if you're working with young kids, you're talking about creating a rich language environment at home. You're talking about using great vocabulary with your kids, telling stories that can extend to literacy learning as well. Because having that rich oral foundation is going to support literacy learning. So again, bringing the literacy back in when that becomes the key mode of instruction, the key mode of performance and assessment in school, it makes sense that that's also our responsibility.
When you say it that way, go ahead.
It makes sense also when you think about that you can't really extract one from the other. You know, it is like expressive and receptive language, which are different, but integrated. Right? You can't really extract receptive from expressive language. They are interconnected. And similarly, when you're thinking, I think, especially about those later reading and writing skills, there are so many things that are coming into play that are, like you said, things that SLPs are working on anyway. They're working on those metacognitive skills. They're working on oral structure. They're working on morphology, potentially, like all of these different things. And I think it can be hard sometimes too, for people who don't realize that if you don't have those skills in your oral language, it's going to be very, very challenging, if not impossible, to develop them as sort of this isolated, discrete skill in the context of writing, right? So if you're having trouble predicting what might happen in an oral exchange with somebody, it's going to be probably that much harder to read a text and make an inference and identify that the person was trying to persuade you and that you might think these thoughts differently because of XYZ. And I think that there's such a place for the SLP in helping integrate all of those thoughts and all of those skills together in reading and writing. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that, like the connection between working on those goals and what you might see in your speech and language outcomes by working on writing skills.
Good question.
That's a really good question. High five, well, Amy.
You know, I like what you were saying about the reciprocal relationship of oral language and literacy. you know, we know it's possible to have oral language. And oral language is a natural thing we acquire, right? Like literacy is an add-on. You don't need literacy to, you know, have oral language. You can have oral language, have a perfectly competent oral language and not have literacy, and that's totally fine. However, I don't think you can have, can you have literacy without oral language? The opposite is not true, right? I don't know. I mean, like you like not that you need to speak. I'm not saying it needs to be oral language, but you need language. You need a language structure in your brain to transfer that language structure into written text, whether it's reading or writing. Because, you know, you need to know words, you need to know sentences, you need to understand, you know, the metacognitive pieces. So then the reciprocal, not that, again, not that you need literacy to have oral language, but there is research showing, for example, that after a certain point, I don't remember exactly the age, but probably like middle high school, you know, adolescents are learning more vocabulary through reading than through oral language. And we can think about ourselves, you know, when did you start really learning from text? You know, maybe it was in college, probably in high school, maybe in middle school, you know, you start acquiring these specialized vocabularies of academic disciplines. You start, you know, learning different expressions and different text structures. I mean, think about writing an essay. When did you really master that skill, right? And so again, like it can feed the opposite way too. So being a strong reader can increase your language vocabulary, which will transition into your oral language as well, if that makes sense. So the question was about goals, right? So I think we're moving into objective number three. Do you wanna rephrase that question again?
Sure, I mean, I guess I was wondering kind of, I guess, about the reverse, right? We've talked a bit about, you know, using authentic writing. We've talked a bit about the oral language and kind of oral language encompassing alternative modes of oral language as well. So not just oral speech language. But then, you know, kind of the reverse of that, when we're looking at creating writing goals, what changes might you expect to see? You already, you know, talked a little bit about it in terms of you may see increase in tier two, tier three vocabulary, right? What are some other things that you might see in speech and language, as well as, you know, connecting it back to either the Common Core or just kind of those grade level standards?
I think again, you know, hand in hand, right? And a good thing about writing is if, say, for example, you want to work on pronouns, right? Being clear with pronominal reference and the pronoun so that you're able to make your story, for example, cohesive. You want the listener to know who you're talking about, who did it. You're not just going to walk in and say, oh, you know, she bought a big bag of cookies and then they ate them all. We need to know who she and they are, right? And this, kids with language impairment do have trouble with this, right? Having trouble with pronouns and lacking pronominal reference. Think about, again, those oral narratives that you've been analyzing for years. Like, how often do you have a kid with a language impairment who's trying to retell a story and you're not quite sure who they're talking about, right? So when you work on that skill in writing, it slows it down for the kid. They can see it. And they can draw a line, they can circle the pronoun and draw a line back to the reference. And it becomes crystal clear who that person is, right? That connection is there. And that's just one example. I mean, you could do this with derivational morphology. You can say, you know, this is the root of the word, I'm gonna underline it. And this is a prefix, and I'm going to circle it, and this is a suffix, right? And learning that those things can be taken apart and put together to create new words, this is going to help with your comprehension and your writing and your spelling. right? And if you have a kid with phonological issues, phonological awareness, or a kid with a speech sound issue, looking at spelling, things like consonant clusters, where are they going to break down based on the speech sound issue, the phonological processes that they're demonstrating? Well, look, what if we attach letters, written letters to those, and we show it? You know, this, maybe you're not going to do this with a preschooler. They're not ready for grapheme phoneme mapping, but second grader can do it. A third grader can certainly do it. And this is really the key of kindergarten, first grade, is grapheme phoneme mapping. So you can even do writing goals that are speech related, because they have to do with phonological awareness. They have to do with phonemic awareness and phoneme grapheme mapping.
Well, and for me, like as somebody who works mostly in augmentative and alternative communication, like I listen to what you just said and I think, oh, of course, it's essentially using the most relevant and curriculum applicable visual support that you possibly could to work on these skills that you—
Yay, relevant curricular, yes, so, always.
You know, because pronouns can be hard. And I mean, back to, I don't know that it makes it authentic writing, but it also makes me think just about it. It seems a heck of a lot more meaningful to work on pronouns in the context of their written production, or even analyzing someone else's written production potentially, than to sit there and do flashcards.
Yeah, why, man, get, throw those flashcards out. You know, you can use authentic meaning, real text that they have to use in the classroom, or real text that they really want to read. They want to read that article about, I don't know, the video game that they're really into, or they want to read that, you know, things like those Scholastics for Kids. You know, those are so great. They're interesting. They're engaging. You know, reading something that is interesting and engaging and applying those skills right there, right? Yeah, good idea, Amy.
It was your idea, but it was a great idea.
And I like that you brought in the curriculum, right? Because, you know, that's always really, really, really critical as well.
Well, and
can I just, back to the soapbox, right?
Yes, get up there.
Get up there.
What you do as an SLP should never be in isolation. Like, please don't take your kid to your office and play games. Like, right? How are they going to transfer that to what they have to do in the classroom? The school SLP, you have to be doing stuff that matters and that will be useful to the kid in the classroom, because the reason they're on your caseload is because whatever impairment or disability they have has an adverse academic impact, exactly. Right? It is, they are on your caseload. Otherwise they're off with like the private practice,
yes.
Because it doesn't impact their learning. If it's impacting their achievement, their progress in the classroom, that's why they're seeing you. So you have an obligation to use that stuff, meaning, you know, those standards, that curriculum that they're going to be using in the classroom in your practice.
Well, and I think, you know, it's such a good point, because to bring it back to the points you were making earlier, speech pathologists are working on a lot of these skills anyway. You don't necessarily have to have an IEP goal that says I'm working on writing in XYZ ways, but it really could be about the tasks that you're using in your therapy room, right?
Yes.
It's about the materials that you're choosing. It's about the anchor on which you're focusing your therapeutic tasks. We talk a bit on this podcast just about, you know, I think that's something the point that when you're in a school, when you're a school-based speech language pathologist, you're operating under a different focus than you are if you are that private practice outpatient person. You have, that's the medical versus school model that I think sometimes people don't fully appreciate, but they really are different. It really is about curriculum access. And it's hard, you know, but it's also hard. I think about K-6 SLPs who are trying to wrap their head around the curriculum for all of these different grades. Yeah. I don't know if you have tips for people about that.
You said something that I wanted to jump back to. You said maybe it's not in your goal, right? But you can still use writing. But you're welcome to also write a writing goal. I mean, you're the SLP. You can write the goal that you want. And right? I mean, and if you're in the school, your goals will look different. Your goals and objectives are different from the goals in a private practice, because those goals and objectives do have to be relevant to what is happening in the classroom. And how, always thinking about, you know, working with language and literacy to support this kid to ultimately make progress, right? To achieve those standards. So it's okay to have writing goals too. You can have writing goals that have to do with syntax, right? Just like you do in oral language. You can have writing goals that have to do with text structure. Like, how about formulating a paragraph, using a graphic organizer, formulating a paragraph that has a topic sentence, 3 supporting details, and a conclusion in 3 out of 4 opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. You can do one with pronouns. Mm-hmm. You can do one with vocab. You can do one with spelling. Using invented spellings that map graphemes and phonemes. I mean, phonological awareness, that's part of the, if you're looking at the Common Core standards, literacy foundational skills for kindergarten, first grade, phonological awareness is there. So that's SLP.
Yeah.
That's your wheelhouse, right?
No, I just think it's a really good point. And I think that it is a place where even, you know, just thinking about the graphic organizers, thinking sort of bouncing up to those higher grades, those upper level grades, you know, you might also be doing things like that if you have students where you're working on sort of some of that perspective taking. I think that's another place where, whether it's an IEP goal about writing or reading or not, I'm medium old, but I'm pretty sure they're still doing this, right? Like, a lot of what I remember from my high school reading was about trying to predict what the character was going to do next, or how the character was thinking, or identifying metaphor. You know, all of those things are hard if you are having trouble doing that anyway. And it seems like a nice opportunity to have a visual, again, to go along with it. You can underline it. You can look for the clues.
That's what I was going to say is the concept of using, you know, we work a lot in AAC, and I think a lot of speech pathologists are very used to using visual supports in their sessions across all students. Everything from, not necessarily, you know, I know we're talking a lot about graphic organizers, but visual schedules, you know, other symbols, movable pictures. Oh, the storybooks that you mentioned earlier that don't have, we're so used to using visual supports. And I think the idea, the very simple idea of using text as a visual support is brilliant. I mean, it is a visual support, and I think that makes so much sense.
Yeah. And it supports the literacy as well. And I think you asked Amy about, you know, how to kind of do all of this as the school SLP that's like spread so thin and has such a big caseload and how that kind of thing. And I think, you know, another thing that I promote a lot is, you know, kind of creative service delivery models, you know, thinking about ways you can work in classrooms, collaborate with teachers, as opposed to having everything in your office, right? I mean, pull out is probably the least efficient thing that you can do. And obviously there will be kids that need one-on-one, but the more you can get into the classroom with a push-in framework, working with a kid who's on your caseload and some other kids that might be on RTI tier 2 or 3, bring them in, you know, get them at the table with you. Work with the teacher to do some kind of, again, look at that Collins and Walter article. It is such a great example of the SLP collaborating with the teacher, integrating with the curriculum, and reaching all kids in the classroom. There are kids on her caseload, and then there's every other kid who still also need to build their morphological awareness. So yes, build relationships with teachers, integrate, push in, And that will definitely also help you learn more about the curriculum and what the kids really need to do.
I think too, knowing, depending on your school, I think especially in this time of COVID and remote learning and all of that, but you know, one shift I've seen in my time working in schools is now some of that stuff is available online. Like sometimes you can just go online and find out, you know, well, you can certainly find out your state's curriculum frameworks online. That's doable, I think, in all of the states.
Textbooks, you yeah. know, if you want to look at social, like what are the fifth graders reading in science? Like what is the science textbook? Look at the textbooks, because that will help you understand the language demands of the classroom of whatever grade level your kid is in. And, you know, that goes for oral language too. You know, if you're looking at that science textbook, well, you bet that teacher will also be using those vocabulary words when they're talking about, I don't know, habitats, mm-hmm. third grade, right? Mm-hmm. Animals and habitats. So we need to know what's going on in the classroom.
And I think every single episode that we publish, we promote the idea of indirect service and how important that is. And if you don't have time on your caseload, trying to advocate to put indirect service in your grid so that you can consult with the teacher and get a feel for exactly what's happening and have a conversation and look in the curriculum a little bit more deeply and talk to the other specialists about some other things that are happening as barriers to curriculum. I think the creativity of, nobody can see me, like both of us like fist pumping with the idea of creative, how important creative service delivery is. So I'm so, so glad that you mentioned that.
Yeah. And you know, building relationships and being visible and being part of the school day, because ideally you want the teachers to come to you too and say, oh my gosh, I have this kid, you know, what could I do? And because I think a lot of times, you know, not all the teachers in the building know what you do.
Right.
And I mean, they should. Ideally, they do all know what you do, but maybe they don't yet. So maybe that's something that you need to work on so that you're like woven into the fabric of the school community, that you are part of that educational community, you know, for all the kids there. And because you supporting your individual kids on your caseload is also, in a way, supporting all the kids at the school, because it's helping your kid feel more comfortable, be able to be more participatory, be able to have better relationships with their peers and their teacher, right? So it really does support like the overall health and culture of the whole school.
I feel very inspired.
I don't think that we can say anything to follow up with that.
That was a good like finishing note.
Yeah, it was. It really was. Is there any other resources or anything else that you want to leave our listeners before we sign off?
We have a robust list already.
Yeah, I will definitely send you some things and you can put them along. I don't know. Do you publish them along with the recording or on
yeah,
your website?
They'll be in the show notes of the podcast and on the episode page on our website. Yep. So everybody who's listening, you can just go through your podcast player and there will be hyperlinks to all of these research articles. There will be a reference list, any other online resource that will all be right there.
Sounds good.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much
for coming. To anyone who is listening, who is interested in using this episode for ASHA CEUs, there is a link to that also in your podcast player. You can also go to our website, www.slpnerdcast.com. If you have questions about this episode or want to have a discussion about what you learned, we have a private Facebook group that you can join called SLP Nerds. Of course, that's what it's called. And feel free to contact us at any time. We love hearing from our listeners. And Robin, thank you again so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. Good luck with writing. You can do it.
Yay.